Ladies and gentlemen, joining us on Bucko Banner today is a very special guest, former first round pick in Major League Baseball, a 16-year professional baseball career, former Pittsburgh Pirate fan favorite, owner, co-founder, and CEO of 3A Athletics, the lunchbox hero, Travis Snyder. Thanks for joining us, Trav.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Trav, welcome on. I'm happy to have you on. As a kid that grew up in Pittsburgh, loved watching those teams from 2012 to 2014, I believe, when you were here. Those were some fun times. I got to ask, you were always referred to as lunchbox hero. Can you elaborate on how that nickname came about?
Yeah, so freshman year of high school, I was 6 foot, 225. I started at middle linebacker on the varsity football team and played between the tackles. A few years prior, there was an upperclassman that had the nickname Lunchbox. And as I started spending more time around the upperclassmen, they saw my ability to eat and why I weighed 225 pounds at 15 years old. So quickly got dubbed that nickname after a late night visit to Taco Bell, where I put down pre-inflation $35 worth of Taco Bell, which is pretty disgusting when you say it out loud. But yeah, it was one of those things where in high school, the upperclassmen called me Lunchbox. Most of my best friends back home that are my age don't ever call me Lunchbox, but it was kind of the younger kid thing. And then as I got into professional baseball and started Twitter, was kind of my first attempt at social media. I wanted to be less about me as a baseball player, more about my personality of getting free meals. It was essentially my goal, was when we go to different cities, I get a free steak, which turned out to be a pretty good investment in terms of my time. I got a lot of free meals throughout my career, which was great. And then really try to build the content around grilling and food related stuff from holidays on through having the boys over on trips to Seattle.
Yeah, that's great. I got to ask you real quick, how do you like your steak and what's the best way to cook it?
I'm a medium rare guy.
There we go. Nice.
Unfortunately, married a woman who is perfect in so many ways, but likes her meat more on the well-done beef jerky side of things. So I've learned to compromise over my life where not everything can be red in the middle if I'm sharing it with her. But for the most part, medium rare, I'm pretty standard with the sear first. I've done the reverse sear too. I think that's great. But I have a sear station that I'll fire that up and get the grill hot, do the searing on both sides. And then outside of cooking steaks, I love to cook on my Traeger. And then I also have a Brio grill that has like a adjustable grill grate and then a sear ring around it, which with young kids, I haven't gotten to use it quite as much as I want to because it's a little bit of a dangerous item. But as we get into the nicer months here, looking forward to grilling some steaks and burgers and roasting marshmallows and all that kind of stuff.
Nice. So growing up in the Pacific Northwest, you were obviously a Mariners fan. Who was your favorite player? Was it Griffey?
Absolutely. Yeah, Ken Griffey Jr.
Nice.
Ken Griffey, A-Rod, Randy Johnson. I think most kids that were alive in the 90s kind of knew of the mid-90s Mariners teams and the special personalities we had. But Ken Griffey Jr. definitely was my favorite player and the one that I tried to emulate oftentimes in the backyard or when we were playing Little League Baseball.
Yeah. How could you not like those guys? I know Scott worked in the Blue Jay system a little bit, and I think he has some stories about his time there that you might be able to relate to.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. So I saw you were drafted by the Blue Jays in 2006, I believe.
Yep.
And I saw you start out in the Appy League. My professional career, I was trying to get into scouting. My first job was a video scout for the Bluefield Blue Jays. Bluefield's a special place. I think I saw you started in Pulaski. I guess the Blue Jays were in Pulaski rather than Bluefield at the
Pulaski
time.
Then used to be the Orioles were in Bluefield, but one of my first professional games was in Bluefield. I mean, it's a beautiful setting up there in the Appalachian Mountains, but as you experience, it's a different beast out there for sure.
So I guess my question is, do you have any special Appy League stories? I feel like everyone has experiences in the Appy League while there. It's a unique place. Like you said, it's in the Appalachians.
Yeah, I mean, we had no cell phone service like around the field. It was kind of a weird deal. So communication was tough. This is back in 2006. There wasn't much as far as food after the game. I think a great story is, it was a first round pick, right? I signed for $1.7 million, even though I wasn't a kid who came from a lot of money. That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
So I meet my agent and I meet my financial advisor to sign my contracts with them as far as my representation goes. And we had the meeting at the Waffle House because that was the only place that was open after the game, right? Normally, you're getting your agent and your financial guy to take you out for a nice steak or something like that. So I made sure to stick it to them later on when we were in bigger cities and make them take me out for the nice steak dinners. But signed the professional contract there. Again, the cultural experience, right? I think for people listening, as 18 or 21, wherever you're at from high school or college or as a video scout, you're immersed in a cultural diffusion, right? That most of us don't grow up with, where you got guys from Puerto Rico, you got guys from Venezuela, you got guys from the Dominican, you got guys from Mexico, you got guys from all different parts of the United States, which I think is one of my favorite experiences of playing baseball, is getting a chance to integrate and diffuse, culturally speaking, with people who speak a different language, who have different belief systems, who have different food that they like to eat, different music that they listen to. I'm sure you listened to more Latin music in your first year of pro ball than you probably ever did in your entire life combined. So again, there's all these things, right? As a first year guy going to the Appy League, that it's a bit of a culture shock, but I was lucky. We had a good mix of veteran guys there, older college guys with some younger high school kids. And I connected with the Latino guys pretty quickly because I could speak enough Spanish to communicate and try and help them, you know, whether it's ordering a cheeseburger or chicken nuggets at McDonald's or just getting through the day-to-day stuff. So a lot of good memories for me in the Appy League.
Yeah, absolutely. I think too, just going to the Appy League from Venezuela or the Dominican is like such a shock, culture shock. And my year was 2016 and it was Vladdy Guerrero's first year in the States. We also had Eddie Olivares, who's now on the Pirates. And just seeing those guys, like, even as a video scout intern, like I was had to be a resource for them and help them acclimate to, you know, life in Bluefield, West Virginia. So, you know, it's been fun watching them grow throughout their careers from there. And I know being there is a motivation for them to move up.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, it's cool how whether the video guy, the athletic trainer, the bat boy, all the way through the clubhouse, right? There's connections that you make with people, lifelong connections, friends that you get to watch go through their careers, whether it is in baseball or on the professional side of baseball. So, always a good time to reminisce on those days.
How much money, $1.7 million, how many waffles do you think that could buy?
A lot of waffles. I don't remember how many I ate, but there's a few stops along my minor league career where we did find the diners where two plates was kind of a standard order for me in my 240-pound plane weight days, where I thought it was necessary for me to order the biscuits and gravy and the what's the hollandaise sauce one? Blanket eggs Benedict. Geez.
Yep.
That or biscuit, you know, just like sloppy diner food, and Waffle House definitely checks that box.
Yeah. I mean, it always hits. Yeah. It always hits. Speaking of the minor leagues, what do you see from, you know, you said you're a kid, a big kid, first round pick. What from the developmental side do they usually implement with guys like you coming in order to get to the league? Is it strict diet, mechanics, overarching approaches that the organization is pushing? How different is that from, you know, one going from high school to the big league level and then switching from organization to organization where things may be different?
Yeah, I think the game has evolved a lot since 2006. I think organizations have put a premium on helping players understand how the daily choices they make impact their performance on the field. And that could be nutrition, right? Back then you would get a couple of tubs of peanut butter and a couple of tubs of jelly and a couple of bags of bread, right? And that was essentially what your pregame spread was. And most of the time at the lower levels, the postgame spread was probably peanut butter and jelly again, or some kind of stuff that doesn't look like it's going to digest well and sit well for the whole body composition goals that we're setting for ourselves. So I think as a whole, organizations across the board have started to invest more into the nutritional aspect. You see the number of coaches and support staff on each roster has probably tripled in size. So they understand the value of having more than just the intern video coordinator there trying to do the things that we should have more guys doing so that you can focus on what you're doing, guys and girls, I should say. The athletic training staff seem to be two or three versus the one trainer who's trying to deal with 15, 20 injuries a day. Which I think is just, again, you're trying to evolve these systems, right, to create better player development, to create a better environment for professionals to actually be able to show up and get better at their job instead of making decisions on a daily basis that are deterrent for that goal. And then, you know, the facilities, I know back when I was in Pulaski, they've done a major renovation to that stadium. I haven't seen it personally, but I've heard great things about
it. The Yankees facility and again, now.
Yeah, so they should have plenty of money there. But being able to have a proper cage, right? I know the legend of Pulaski was the visiting clubhouse was pretty grinder. And I've been in some grinder visiting clubhouses, and the old Nashville Stadium, you're in kind of a portable slash double wide trailer. And just creating a healthier environment where you don't have black mold and you don't have showers that are riddled with staph infection. And I think of what guys went through in the 70s and 80s, and you watch a movie like Bull Durham and how disgusting everything looks in that clubhouse. I think since I was there, it's gotten exponentially better. The facilities right in Florida are top notch pretty much across the board now, because the pressures on organizations to try and invest funds into the player development side, which I know Pittsburgh is an organization that's famously put a lot of time and energy and money into creating very world-class experiences for their players at every level. And I think as they've kind of shrunk down the minor leagues, they've been able to control the quality a little bit better and focus those funds and energies into things that are actually going to have a return on investment for the players and for the team.
Yeah. No, we were at Pirate City this March, actually. We got a tour of it. Pretty cool place. I lived for a year in Florida. I lived in Port St. Lucie when I was interning with the Mets, and their facility was, I thought that's how all facilities were, but it was well behind the Pirates. So you can definitely see they've invested in the having the necessary resources available for the players, having the dorms there. I don't know about what your thoughts are on the dorm situation. I know some guys don't like that. It feels like college, but still, like I've seen players being put up in disgusting hotels and living situations. So it beats that for sure.
Yeah, I lived in a Red Roof Inn temporarily during instruction week. So after the season in Pulaski, I flew back down to Florida and spent 5 or 6 weeks in the training program there. And you're staying in hotels that, I mean, I grew up staying in those hotels because I didn't have a lot of money. But once you start to experience things that are a little higher class than the Red Roof Inn, you try and find the balance, right, between what's necessary and what's kind of sanitary and safe for your players. Having spent a lot of time in the minor leagues too, I've stayed in plenty of hotels with bed bugs and questionable hygiene as far as how they clean the rooms. Pretty much all those rooms I feel like are disgusting, but luckily that was something I just kind of embraced along the way and just made the most of those experiences.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely a lot of adversity that you have to battle. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that are not huge baseball fans what you have to go through before you actually get to the show. There's no guarantee that you're going to get there and how you have to work your way up. When you made your debut, you were 20 years old, right? And yep. that was with the Blue Jays. Can you talk a little bit how that experience was? One, you know, I'd like to hear the call-up story. I always love those. What was that like? Yeah. And then, you know, talk about your debut and that experience.
Yeah, so 2008, I started the year in high A, was quickly called up to double A. Struggled for a little bit, caught fire there, got called up to AAA because somebody had punched a water cooler and a roster spot open. And I had played well enough. So like, hey, go finish the last 3 weeks in AAA. I had met with the assistant GM who was a big part of drafting me a couple years prior. And he had told me, hey, you've had a great season. You're going to finish the year here. You're going to go back to the Arizona Fall League for a second round. And I said, hey, okay, great. My goal was to get to the big leagues, but I felt like I did everything I could. So I shipped my car, I shipped my suits, I shipped everything that you would need in case of a call-up, right? So then 2 days later, I get taken out of the lineup in game two of a doubleheader. And as a prospect, you're playing every day, every game, before there was the load management stuff. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, that's weird. They took me out of the lineup. They just told me 2 days before. That's something that kind of happens if you're getting called up usually, but I try not to overthink it. And then I was sitting by our hitting coach, Al LaBeouf, who's still in baseball, I think 25 years later. And he's sitting there and starts making comments about the big league lights and how it's different up there and you can see better. And I'm just kind of looking at him like, what are you trying to say here? And he's just kind of got this shit eating grin, excuse me for the language, but just got the smile on his face, right? Where I'm just like, okay. And then I get called into the manager's office, and sure enough, the assistant GM that I had talked to a few days prior was there, and they had just traded Matt Stairs, who was their veteran DH kind of left-handed bat. And they said, you know what, you're going to Yankee Stadium. This is old Yankee Stadium, 2008, last year was open. You're going to be taking a town car tomorrow morning and arriving in New York, and you'll be playing for the Toronto Blue Jays tomorrow night. And I, to me, it was just like a huge shock. I kind of picked up on it as we were going through that second game and some of the hints that I was getting. But I also realized at the time, like, okay, I have no suit. I have no, none of my stuff that I would want to have in this situation, but who cares? Like at this point, this is the best news I've heard in my entire life. So I ended up calling my buddy, and he booked five tickets, which at the time there was only first class flights available. So five of my dad and four of my sister and three best friends flew out first class to New York City. I arrived in New York that morning via town car. Don't think I slept more than an hour or two the night before. I was just so excited and roll into the big city and ended up connecting with one of the veteran guys, Johnny Mack, and who became a good friend and played with me on the Pirates later in our career. But Johnny Mack made sure I got to the stadium and got into the clubhouse and went through the whole pregame experience. And I just remember looking up in the stadium and seeing that third deck, right? AAA, you get kind of the second deck experience where now it's becoming like a much bigger visual. And then I'm seeing this third deck that just goes all the way around the stadium. And I remember during batting practice, our outfield first base coach was our former minor league hitting coach, who I had a great relationship with. And every ball that was hit in batting practice, I'm breaking and running 25 feet, and ball could have been in right field and I'm going to get it, right? So he comes over to me in left field. He's like, "Hey, bud, take a deep breath. You don't have to go and get every ball out here. Just have fun, enjoy it." Talked to Scott Rowland, Hall of Famer, came up to me before the game and gave me some advice that I passed on to a lot of players since is, you only get one debut. So whether you go for four or four for four, enjoy every moment of this experience. Don't put too much pressure on yourself to make it a storybook deal. And then I ended up starting in left field. AJ Burnett was on the mound, who was also on the mound for my Pirates debut, which is kind of a cool fun fact for Buccos fans. And then I ended up hitting a soft line drive to Jeter, my first at bat for an out. Caught a changeup off the front foot, hit it over Damon's head in center for a ground rule double, bounced over the center field fence, and I got to second base. And the first person to congratulate me on my major league debut and my first hit in the show was Derek Jeter. So he came over and kind of put his arm on me and was like, "Hey, is that your first one?" I was like, "Yeah." He said, "Pretty cool, man. Congratulations." So again, one of those stories I look forward to telling my grandkids about and my kids when they're old enough to understand how cool it was not only to get to debut in old Yankee Stadium with all the history and it being its last year of existence, and then getting a chance to talk to Derek Jeter, my first game of the show, two things that I'll remember for the rest of my life.
That's awesome. Growing up idolizing Derek Jeter, that's pretty cool.
I mean, he's a guy, right? Outside of Griffey, Jeter was one of those guys as a kid where you're like, I'd love to be 1/10 of what Derek Jeter is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Travis, did you ever feel pressure being a first round pick, being, a high selection by the Blue Jays? Did you ever feel pressure to perform or at any point in your career? And if so, how'd you navigate that?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what's led into the whole 3A athletics and what I'm doing now is not really understanding some of the pressure I felt was conscious, right? But a lot of it was subconscious, right? Not in the everyday thoughts that I was having, but just pressure that had been building from 9 years old, winning our first state championship and essentially establishing myself as the best player in the state of Washington and maintaining that status all the way through 18 years old and being a first round pick and winning our state championship senior year. So I always experienced that kind of pedestal feeling where people were like, "Oh, he's the baseball player." And, you meet coaches and you meet players from other teams around the state and they kind of treat you differently because you've had success on the field. And that starts to build something that I think it's really important for parents and coaches in youth sports and in professional sports to understand how that identity starts to get formed, right? Based off of our achievements. And it wasn't something until much later in my career, I was able to really kind of revisit and understand with a different perspective of how those youth sports experience kind of propped me up for success, but it also was propping me up on a foundation that wasn't really solid, right? And that's something we talk about a lot in our content is the elephant on the pool cue. I convinced a lot of people, including the organization and all the scouts that pegged me as a first round pick and can't miss prospect, one of the best hitters in the minor leagues and won some MVP awards along the way to prove that. So physically I felt like I was ready, but mentally and emotionally, as much as I had convinced everybody around me I was ready for that moment, I wasn't ready for the failure, right? That eventually came 3 months later, or I should say September went really good. That was my basically month showcase. And then April was really, really good, right? And at that point, instead of feeling the pressure, I started the ego started to really take over, projecting, okay, if we just do this five more times, we're going to be the rookie of the year. And then in 3 years, we're going to be in arbitration. In 5 years, we're going to sign this massive contract. Now I'm going to be a lifelong Blue Jay. I'm going to be a middle of the order hitter. And as things didn't go to plan, right, that narrative that my ego had started to really hone in on, and reading the articles about myself. And in Toronto, I had a much different experience than I did in Pittsburgh in terms of the media coverage. Being a first round pick was a big deal, but being labeled kind of as a franchise player was something that started to kind of build in my subconscious that pressure. Am I really that good? Right. And I think physically I had all the tools to get it done. I dealt with injuries throughout my career, but mentally and emotionally, I wasn't ready when I got sent down in 2009, right? Which 2.5, 3 months into the season, it's probably around this time in May in 2009, I get sent down to AAA. And what we talk about in the youth sports space is like, the feeling of winning and losing is life or death, right? When kids are too young to really handle that experience. And that was something I carried with me because I never really failed other than a short stint in AA. At that point, it was like my world was crumbling, and all these nice things and all these nice articles and all these nice things I started to believe about myself were just unraveling. And I emotionally was not capable of really processing and grieving that in a healthy way. So it's things that I started to do throughout my career to cope with the stress, whether it was, you know, making poor choices away from the field or not being able to manage the stress and anxiety of showing up to the park and seeing your name at the 8 spot instead of the 3 spot, because that's where you hit all the time in the middle of the order in the minor leagues as a prospect. A lot of these little triggers that I started to become aware of throughout my career, working with some great people in the space of sports psychology and just mental performance, but not really understanding the really deeper root issues, right, that started in my childhood experiences and with all the hype and narratives that were being spun around me as a franchise player. So that was something that I did a really good job of continuing to convince people I was okay. Even though I was self-sabotaging in certain ways, I was making choices along the way that just the behavior didn't match kind of what I wanted for myself on who I feel like I really am as a person. And I think for people listening to understand, let's use Neil Walker as an example. Neil Walker was a Pittsburgh kid. He was a first round pick. The amount of grace and professionalism that I witnessed from Neil Walker, and he's still a good friend of mine today, was second to none. And the way that he handled the pressure of being a guy that lived in his own city and had to leave tickets for all the friends and all the family, and everybody wants a piece of Neil Walker, right? Because he's the Pittsburgh kid. I looked at Neil, not in a sense of jealousy, but in admired, like admiration of how well he handled those things. But I just wasn't equipped, right? Mentally and emotionally, I wasn't equipped to be able to handle the pressure without being somebody in my home city. So I wanted to use that example because I think Bucko fans will resonate with, and I hope that gives everybody some extra motivation to go comment on Neil's Twitter or whatever social media he's using now. And I know he's still intimately involved in the broadcast stuff, but seeing how different guys navigate that landscape, it's always fascinating to me to understand kind of what every one of us has as far as a history goes and what's in our conscious mind and our subconscious mind, but how we handle that pressure, how we handle the emotional stresses and how we cope with that stuff is something that I learned a lot throughout my career, but never really got to the root of it. And I think that's what, since I've retired, I've been focused on really unpacking, but what was all that pressure I was feeling? How much of it was because of the youth sports experience? How much of it was my off the field family stuff that I was dealing with? So I think for me is just trying to humanize the aspect of professional sports. Again, you're a fan, you pay money to go to the game. If you want to boo, you want to boo, that's your thing. But understand that there are humans, right, wearing those jerseys. And as much as we want to win and we want to see a winning product on the field every single year, every single night, it's a difficult thing to do, be consistent at. And that's why you see so many guys that don't reach their potential in their careers because of that pressure and how it affects them.
Yeah. I mean, that really resonates with me because I feel like, I think I've heard you say this before, but in the early years, you're creating an identity of like who you are, whether that's through sports or whatever hobby activity that you're pursuing. Those formative years are kind of where you establish yourself in terms of relationships, where you feel like you're going in life, your attitude, mental toughness. So I could see like it when I started reading about that and hearing you guys talk about it, I'm like, wow, like my whole life, and I'm sure Scott could relate, it's all baseball, baseball, baseball. Like your relationships with your family, it revolves around baseball. You know, when you're doing well, things are good. When you're not doing well, it's like you're down. So you're looking back on it and you're like, wow, like my good memories are baseball, but also like the bad memories are also baseball. And it's like,
yep,
I have a hard time remembering anything outside of that in terms of good memories or bad memories. So, I mean, it's definitely something, like you said, with 3A athletics, like exploring those years and teaching parents how to navigate that in order to establish that identity, but not make it so centered around one thing. Would you agree with that?
For sure. And I think to highlight what you said, 0 to 10, right? Age-wise, we're trying to answer two questions. Am I safe? Am I loved? Right. And there's all these other things that come into play with that. But those are the two main questions we're trying to answer as a 0 to 10. And I have 3 kids in that space right now. It's incredibly difficult day in and day out with all the stresses that parenting brings and all the pressure of youth sports that we feel like convicted in decisions that we make that we can later realize and reflect that maybe that wasn't the best decision. So above all else, we don't want to demonize parents. We don't want to, you know, play the shame and blame game, right? It's like, hey, this is a bigger conversation we all need to be having, especially those of us with kids. And all of us that are grownups were kids at one point, right? And we can all tap back into the memories that you're talking about of like, what are your top 3 or top 5 sports memories as a kid with your parents, with your coaches, good, positive, and negative? And how do those impact the way that you parent your child now? How does it impact the way you react when your son's up at the plate and the umpire makes a bad call and you feel this intense emotion inside of you and you snap at the umpire who's a volunteer or somebody who makes $10, $15 an hour to come umpire a Little League game? It's like getting to the root of those triggers, right? And I think there's a word that we use, trauma. And trauma has a stigma around it that the only way you can have trauma or have been traumatized is to go to war, have just these horrible, horrible childhood experiences, which I can check some of those boxes, not going to war, but some tough things I dealt with in my family life. But normalizing the term trauma to where it hasn't have to be the victim mentality, where it has to be, hey, all of us have negative experiences, and they range from very extreme to like something you wouldn't even think is that negative, but somehow, some way that's been stuck in your subconscious for 20, 30 years as an adult. And that's creating reactions to certain situations where you don't understand why you're snapping at your child or you're snapping at the umpire or you're yelling at the coach because your son's not playing shortstop and he's playing left field. And the whole concept of hero is really bringing this to the forefront for parents to go through and experience, right? This is a workbook, a guidebook, we call it, for parents to actually go through and write some stuff down and do some critical thinking and reflect on their past experiences. And then be able to formulate important, impactful conversations that you have with your kids so that you understand what does your son or daughter feel like when you cheer from the stands, right? Because that's something we do innately as parents, because we think our kids need the encouragement all the time, when a lot of times that just makes kids more scared, right? And I think every kid has a different personality, so it's case to case and how you kind of handle these things. But if your son or daughter is 5, 6, 7 years old, and you're pushing them to play sports because you want the social connection, you want the exercise, you want all the quality things that sports can teach your child, but understand that they have every right and it's very normal for them to be scared. Right. And one of my kids does not like to hit in front of a crowd. We can hit all day in the backyard. As soon as we go to the ballpark and his t-ball team is hitting, he's like, Dad, I want to go to the park. And for me as a dad, the initial response was, no, we got to put him back out on the field. Right. Because that's what most parents think you have to do in that situation. I would encourage parents to think about it from a different way. What do you think is going to make your child feel the most safe and the most loved? Right. It's not forcing them out onto that field. It's not saying just get back out there and hit the ball. Go spend the time at the park. Be present with them. Play with them in the backyard instead, or at the park, instead of forcing them into organized sports at such a young age. There are some kids that handle it much better than other kids, right? And there's plenty of experiences that can be gained from playing sports before you're 10 years old. It's just become so normalized for parents to feel that pressure to have to push their kids in there at such a young age. And if they don't like it, they want to force it. You know what I mean? Or some of the parents that, again, this is a reaction we get from a lot of parents, is like, yeah, I know sports world is toxic. And I know those crazy parents that you're talking about, but I'm not one of them. Right? Because I don't have trauma, or I don't traumatize my kids. And it's like, well, yeah, we do. Like parenting is damaging our kids, like constantly. It's just mitigating the risk, right? And the damage that we're doing and learning how to repair so that we can create a healthy relationship. So that when our kids are 14, 15, they don't hate baseball or whatever sport they're playing. They don't hate mom or dad because mom or dad shoved it down their throat. Or if they play even longer, helping them understand the difference between who you are and what you do, right? And those 0 to 10 years that we're talking about is like, am I safe? Am I loved? Okay. We get out of that stage. Now we start to really introduce what is winning and what is losing. How do we succeed gracefully? How do we fail gracefully? How do we learn from failure? All these things have to be built on those 0 to 10 years. And a lot of times what we have done as a culture of parents and coaches in youth sports is just push that pressure on the kids at too young of an age. And it's not following what has proven to be kind of the child development stages that we're in. And we want to make it about runs scored and outs and, you know, whose kid got three hits and what we're ranked in the state. And it's like, guys, if you look back in 6 years and you can tell me your child has a healthy relationship with the sport, I'll tip my cap. But I'm going to bet the house that the vast majority of these kids are either going to hate the sport or they're going to love the sport, but there's so much of their identity and self-worth is tied up in their success on and off on the field, not off the field.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating that you're focusing on the parenting too, because I know like all of us have the experiences from playing baseball or basketball growing up. Like I know for me, growing up playing basketball too, I saw parents that would not let their kids eat if they didn't play well. Like it sounds crazy, but it happened. How much of, and you mentioned the word trauma and you mentioned pressure, parents feeling pressure. How much do you think it's parents trying to vicariously live through their children for maybe a father who didn't make it or something like that?
There's definitely a percentage of parents like that. I would say as a parent who had kind of a rough relationship with my parents at times, there's definitely things that I bring into my parenting style that I've either had to become aware of and really start to pull back and understand why I'm doing that and how to do it differently. Some people just kind of grow up with that. I'm going to do it differently than my parents because they did it so bad. I kind of towed that line of trying to do a little bit of both. And I think, again, for parents listening, it's not about being a perfect parent. It's about being willing to do the work, right? And we want our kids to grow up and we want them to grow and evolve and learn and all these things. But we get to a point in our 20s and 30s where it's like, I'm just going to flag plant. This is who I am. This is how I am. Instead of saying, how could I be a better version of myself? And that's really what Hero is designed to do, is help parents tap into some of those memories of childhood sports, tap into what it is they're experiencing while they're watching their kid play the sport. It could be joy, it could be anger, it could be frustration, anxiety, because you can't control what's happening on the field, right? And especially when it gets more competitive, it becomes a very intense emotional experience for parents. How are we projecting that on our kids? There are obvious examples that you're talking about of trying to live vicariously through your child, but there's also less obvious examples of parents trying to do the right thing by coaching their kids when they get in the car after the game and saying, hey, you need to be more respectful. You need to stay down on that ground ball. When in that moment, the most important question you should be asking your kid is, do you need a parent or do you need a coach? Or more simply put, how are you doing, right? And just getting them a chance to start being to associate their feelings with what's going on and start to articulate and speak their own truth. Because so many times we as parents want to fix the problems, right? And that's what creates an enabled generation of children that don't know how to solve problems themselves. So it's like finding that balance between being a parent who wants to instill grit and discipline and all these wonderful life skills that sports can teach, but not doing it too early and learning how to reframe those conversations with their children and think about it from a different perspective. Because again, we're products of our past experiences. The way our parents raised us a lot of times will dictate how we raise our kids. And if we're lucky enough to be surrounded with like-minded people that want to grow and continue to learn and be better versions of ourselves, so that in turn, we can show our kids, right, by modeling that behavior. And it's not a really good example to sit in the stands yelling at your son to throw strikes or your daughter to throw strikes when you don't realize, like, what is that actually doing to them? It might work right in the moment, but over time, what kind of relationship are you building? What is that feedback loop going to look like in 4 or 5 years when your son or daughter doesn't want to come to you for advice, right? Because they're tired of hearing the coach's voice from mom or dad instead of the mom or dad that's just like, hey, you're loved, you're safe. How are you feeling?
Yeah, you could see it. I mean, obviously, you could see it from the parent side, right? Because like you said, they feel like they're contributing in the moment, but you're really not looking at how it makes your son or daughter feel. I know my dad, one thing, I mean, we've talked about this later on in life. One thing he would do that he thought would help if I wasn't hitting or playing well, he would just leave the game. And then I would start playing well and he'd be like, oh, you're playing well because I left the game. I'm like, playing well because you're not there.
Yeah.
You know, to criticize me, or it's that pressure of, you know, constantly performing in order to maintain those relationships. What I like that you bring to 3A athletics in terms of the baseball standpoint, it's a game of failure, right? It's quite possibly the most mental game that you could play in any sport. You're going to fail 7 out of 10 times, and then you're really, really good. Do you think that contributes at all? Like if we're focusing just on baseball as kids, like allowing them to experience that failure and the ups and downs of the game, in order to kind of feel it out themselves? Or is that something that kind of needs guidance given, you know, the mental fortitude that you have to, in order to succeed?
Yeah, I think, again, it's kind of what stage are you at with your child in terms of their development? What is your skill set and experience like leading you to want to help them through that process? But yeah, the parent-child relationship is the most important. So creating trust for children to be able to speak their truth to how they feel, then in turn opens the door for you to be able to help them process those emotions in a healthy way, right? And that's really what emotional intelligence is doesn't mean you don't get angry, doesn't mean you don't get sad. It's, okay, I have these feelings, now what am I going to do with them, right? And understanding a 6-7-year-old kid when they're having a meltdown, you're not going to be able to logic and reason them into a calmer state, right? They just need a parent that's there to be sturdy in their presence, hold their energy, and understand that they are still loved and they're still safe. And that's a tough thing for parents because none of us want to raise kids that are entitled. We don't want to raise kids that are speaking back to other adults or taunting the other team. But these are things that happen every day in youth sports that trigger parents to want to get pissed off and start yelling at kids instead of, and I'm guilty of this at times too with my own son, where it's like, I want to make sure sportsmanship's first. But if I don't ask him where this is coming from, if we don't get to the root of what's causing the reaction that I'm seeing on the field, it's easy just to sit there and criticize when you say something to the other team that's negative. But let's get to the root of this, right? And I think that's something for us as parents is understanding a lot of these things aren't just quick fix, one-time conversations. It's learning, teaching our kids and ourselves personally, learning how to get to the root of these triggers and what really gets us emotionally charged positively and negatively, right? Because once you can start to unpack that stuff and create the awareness, now you can start to leverage this energy for a lot of positive and a lot of good and a lot of hard work and a lot of discipline. But when that starts too young, right, then kids are really looking at their parents and looking at themselves and like, what really makes me valuable to mom and dad? Is it if I go out and get 3 hits or is it if I just go out there and play hard and put in good effort, which is what most parents tell us? Well, I just want our kid to have fun and I want them to work hard. And it's like, well, that's great. And I think that's a wonderful thing to want as a parent. But I would also encourage you to think, if your kid doesn't want to work hard or they don't have a good attitude, what is really behind all that? Not just the reaction, but like what's the root cause of this? And I think that's the overarching theme of what we're trying to accomplish with all of our products is there's a lot of great sports psychology out there to help with tips and tricks and different ways to reframe experiences, which is a very important part of this process. But if we're not willing to go deeper, if we're not willing to get to the root of these things, we can just say, oh, it's a bad kid or he's got a bad attitude or whatever. It's like, no, there's probably something underneath that that's triggering him to want to treat people or her to want to treat people in a way that we don't think is appropriate or respectful. So to answer your question, I don't think it's just baseball. Baseball is a great, obvious example because of how much failure there is. I'm an avid golfer now, which is maybe more mentally difficult than baseball, even though you don't have to hit 99 with rise and sliders and all that stuff. Right. But like, it's just you and your score, right? And how you can attach yourself to good shots, bad shots, a handicap, an overall score, right? So I love kind of staying in that space mentally where it's a difficult sport that I play because there's a lot of mental challenges that come with it. But you already gave an example, right? Of basketball, how parents react. And I've been in the arena as a basketball player in youth sports. I've also been at sporting events since I've been older and just watching and observing the energy within the parents in those stands. It's intense, right? There's a lot of anxiety and not to shame or throw blame on parents. It's just like, this has become normalized, right? And we all think it's okay to sit there and snap from the stands when it's like, no, we're supposed to be the ones that are projecting like a solid foundation of emotional intelligence for our kids to then be able to look at us and be like, okay, I don't have to treat this as if it's life or death because it was just one shot or one game or one tournament. And it's not going to define who I am for the rest of my life.
Yeah. I love that you said getting to the root of it, because I think that's so important. I was around a bunch of mental skills coaches while interning in baseball. And I'm a big proponent of that too. I think every guy should utilize those services. I wish I had a mental skills coach when I played in college. I was a pitcher locally here, but you know, I've seen so many kids burn out because of their parents at a very young age. So I'm just curious, like, I think we just jumped into the topic. What was your motivation to get involved with 3A and how did it all start? Tell us about the origin story there.
Yeah. So I started working with my now partner, Seth Taylor. He's the one that wrote Hero. He's the one that wrote Coach's Revolution, which is our coach's guidebook. It'll be coming out in the next couple months. He and I collaborated on an athlete's journal that's going to be coming out. And then we have a podcast that we have 12 episodes that we'll be releasing over the next 3 or 4 months. And prior to all of this, Seth had written this guidebook for parents and for coaches for youth soccer. Backwards or back up even further, I started working with Seth after my father passed away in December of 2020. And I'd lost my mom 12 years prior to that, or 13 years, yeah, 12 years prior to that. So again, the second loss of a parent, I'd been in this space of working with tons of great people in the world of sports psychology, but starting to realize like how unfulfilled I felt at the end of my career, how much of my identity was tied to the first round pick and the youngest player in the major leagues, and how things didn't go to the narratives that I talked about, my ego projecting and the media and everybody around me. And I realized, okay, the person I am now is not the person I want to be, right? When I go home and eventually retire, one of the hardest things of transitioning out of playing sports is wife and husband now are in the same house all the time, right? And there's tons of statistics to back up how many marriages fail. And my wife and I are far from a perfect married couple, but we've put in a lot of work over the last 3 years in marriage counseling to help unpack a lot of the things that I brought in and she wasn't aware she brought in. Again, we talk about the root causes. Seth was a guy I started working with. He's a therapeutic life coach, and he works with guys in the MLS. He works with guys in the MLB. He works with high-level CEOs. He also works with parents and kids in youth sports. And as I was working with him, I realized he had written this book, which was titled something different at the time. Wasn't really being promoted, sold. The business was just kind of there. And I said, hey, what's going on with this? And we were able to buy out his former partner. I was able to purchase the IP and enter a partnership agreement with him. And then we kind of sat down and brought in our third partner and said, okay, we have a parent guidebook, we have a coach's guidebook, but we don't want to just sell books, right? We want to create a company, we want to build a brand around the culture of youth sports, the mental health of athletes, parents, and coaches in the world of youth sports, because there's so much talked about at the top levels of sports psychology and peak performance. But this is kind of the grassroots, right, of human development, right, not player development. I think that's something I've always been passionate about as I went through my own experiences of understanding how much organizations invest in the player development side. And they've started to catch up a little bit with the psychology and the whole health and wellness space, right, that's really blown up over the last 15 years. But there's still a lot of surface, and you can only go so deep, right, as an employer. There's the employee-employer relationship dynamic that makes it very difficult for a Travis Snyder to open up to the sports psychologist of the Pittsburgh Pirates, because there's some way, shape, or form it's getting back to the front office, right? And the front office has to do their job to gather as much information as they can, whether they're going to offer me a arbitration contract or an extension. So it's like this cat and mouse game that's unfortunately a real part of professional sports and just the employer-employee relationship, where I started seeking, you know, kind of counsel outside of the organizations to get a fresh perspective, but also kind of protect myself. And that led me to working with Seth. And once I started working with Seth, I started to realize how much of my stuff stemmed from my childhood, how much I was seeing once I got into the world of business, how many high-level performing people, whether you're a top-level lawyer or somebody who's a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, how many people that have success but don't feel fulfilled, right? And they don't have happy marriages. They don't have great relationships with their kids. They might be very successful and achieve a lot of things, right? Which we talk about the achievement identity of like what we do is who we are, and how many trophies and how many state titles I won is what defines me as a person. It's really not. I mean, it might be why some people know who I am, but it's easy to get lost in success the same way it's easy to get lost in failure. And I think whether you work at McDonald's or you're the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, so many of us are completely unaware of what we have as far as emotional baggage. Trauma is the word we use. We'll say negative experiences, right? So it feels less stigmatized, that just dictate the way that we react in situations, the way that we view the world. And I think for anybody that could be listening to this and might be struggling mentally, I would encourage you to kind of lean into good resources. Parents obviously buy our book. We know this is a big part of what we're trying to do, but there's tons of great resources out there for people who may be struggling with anxiety or identity crisis that a lot of us go through in our 30s, especially when we have kids and things are just kind of going crazy, and trying to make sense of who we are and what's our purpose, right? And I think that's a deeper question that a lot of us are scared to have those conversations around. And I think it's something that sports for me, and youth sports especially, because we can impact more kids at the youth sports level. Eventually, I want to get into working with more guys at the higher levels of college and professional sports. But as of now, our focus is really on the parents, because the parents are the most important piece in this whole experience for kids. And then the healthier, We can help parents become an understanding the healthier relationships, the healthier dynamics of their relationship with their kid in sport creates healthier athletes, right? And then coaches have to deal with a lot less drama, which we haven't really given coaches much love here, but there's a ton of youth coaches that are great coaches that are just burnt out on why little Timmy's not playing as much as little Johnny and having to deal with 400 text messages and emails from parents on a monthly basis because they're not happy with how things are going with their kids.
Yeah. Using the resources is crucial, right? And just having the conversation definitely helps push this forward and getting people to talk about it more and understand who they are and what's causing the anxiety, the depression, instead of just burying it, right? But yeah, I mean, I couldn't be more behind this movement. Utilize, you know, like you said, it doesn't have to be sports related. It could just be anything in your general life, whether you're a CEO, a retail worker, a student, reach out, talk to somebody, because when you're dealing with anxiety or depression, it feels like you're alone, right? You're the only one that's going through it. You're not, most people deal with, you know, these things, and it's just not, as a society, we haven't really made it acceptable to talk about until fairly recently, where mental health has become more of a pivotal point in helping people overcome, you know, whatever they're going in their lives and use their resources. So, you know, we're really behind this 3A athletics movement. Get the book, go check out the website, the podcast. Travis, we want to talk a little bit about your time with the Pirates. And I think it's a good transition, because you said, you know, you had some battles with adversity while you were with the Blue Jays. You got sent down, you're a former first round pick. You get traded in 2012 to the Pirates for Brad Lincoln, who was also a first round pick. Mm-hmm. How did that help in terms of your career with a change of scenery? Was there any team philosophies or leadership in that clubhouse that really helped turn things around or helped your approach mentally?
Yeah, so I didn't realize until I got to Pittsburgh how much stuff I was carrying with me from Toronto. And it took years, even after I left Pittsburgh, to continue to process and work through those experiences in Toronto that were negatively affecting me, whether consciously or subconsciously. When I arrived in Pittsburgh, it was a different culture in the sense of, I didn't know the guys like I knew them in Toronto, because I came up with a lot of guys early on. It was a lot of vets and me. And it was like, if you talk to the sports psych guy, it was like the head doctors here. There was a real stigma around it. As much as I love the vets, that's just kind of the way the culture of baseball was. When I got to Pittsburgh, it was a massive shift in terms of, you know, you got Clint Hurdle at the helm, who's very outspoken and transparent about his ups and downs of his career, mental health, et cetera, right? That I think kind of sets the tone for vulnerability, which I think is a huge component that a lot of us fear as human beings, is being vulnerable, being able to talk about our shit and deal with it in a healthy way. But the culture that him and Neil Huntington were really trying to build was a winning culture, and it was a family culture. It was a lot of guys that played selflessly for each other, regardless, because you got a lot of former first round picks that kind of end up in that organization, right? Because they're buying low on guys that have these massive upsides. And then you got the guys like Neil and Pedro and Garrett Jones. I guess he wasn't originally a Pirate, but you got a good just mix of guys, Andrew McCutchen being the superstar, right? A really like close bond that we created. You had Russell Martin into that mix. You got Garrett Cole coming up as a young stud prospect. You got Grilly, you got Mark Melanson. So you got just this whole mesh of leaders within this team that all have different kind of stories of how they got there. And I think what Clint and the coaching staff did a really good job of for a number of years was really getting guys to buy in to that culture of pick each other up. Don't feel sorry for yourself. If you need to say something, get it off your chest, but let's learn how to do it in a respectful, professional way. And I think from my own personal experience there, I was given tons of opportunities, right? Because they did trade for me. So there was a little different experience than I had than some of the guys that came through the organization. But as a whole, I think that's what led to us having the limited success that we did, but kind of creating somewhat of a sustainable model for success in Pittsburgh, was the culture that they really focused on building. And I think it's a credit to all those guys that I named and the 30 or 40 other guys that I didn't name, the AJ Burnett's and Rob Barajas's, Clint Barmas, that really found ways to impact the clubhouse in a positive way and help get guys kind of over those humps of feeling sorry for themselves. For example, I was an opening day starter in 12 and 13, and I think again in 14. And at some point I was the 25th guy on the roster. I was a bench player. In 2014, I pitched in a game. I got in a fight. I was a pinch hitter that led the league in pinch hits. And then I was starting every day, lefty or righty, down the stretch going into the playoff run, and then got to start against Madison Bumgarner. So you had those times and periods where things weren't going your way personally, but the team was winning. And it created this sense of we're playing for something bigger than ourselves, which I think gets lost very quickly at the professional level because so much of your career arc is based off of your statistics, right? So all of us want to go out there and hit 30 home runs and drive in 100 and hit 300 and be the guy. But to win championships, which we never eventually accomplished that goal, but to get to where we got to, it really took 25 plus the 15, 20 guys that were going up and down, buying into that culture that they had created, and really putting the onus on the players in the clubhouse to protect what was sacred to us, right? Is that energy field that can quickly be penetrated by media, by front office, by coaching staffs, by the fan base that shows up or doesn't show up, right? And it's kind of like we talk about the minor leagues. It's like you don't understand how grinder some of those situations can be. But I think one of the biggest takeaways I have in life experiences is you don't have to, you get to. That's a Clint Hurdle quote, or probably not his originally, but one he'd say all the time. And be where your feet are, right? And for us, it was in the minor leagues, you could sit there and complain about the hotels, you could complain about the bus trips, you can complain about the flights, but all that's going to do is just lower your energy and to not be able to go out there and achieve the great things you want to do. You could be the bench player. What I think was probably the coolest thing is I think back of Tabata, Gabby Sanchez, myself, Ike Davis, you know, all of us at some point were big prospects and first top round picks and had success. We were then the bench guys. And, you know, we had to find ways not only to support the guys that were there on the field day in and day out and keep their spirits up, whether it's Kutch or somebody might have a bad week or a bad game. McHenry's another great name to throw into that mix because he's still involved with it.
Right.
Really buying into finding ways to help make the guys around you better when you can't be on the field. But also the internal competition that we put forth was like showing up early and going out and running sprints and having a workout program, preparing ourselves for when that moment eventually came, whether it was Jeff Banister coming down the fifth or sixth inning saying, get ready to hit, or hey, the pitcher spot's up next day, you know. And I think, again, National League isn't what it used to be. That was such a fun experience of being a bench player in the NL back then because you actually got into games more often. It's much more challenging in the AL to really stay engaged because you might get into a game, you know, once or twice right. a week if you're not an everyday guy. Whereas at that time, we had dudes that were just bought in to find ways to get better in between our starts, to find ways to prepare better for pinch hit situations. And we took a lot of pride in that. And I think that's part of the success that we had was not only our starters, we had great pitching staffs and we had great, superstars on our team, but we were also able to really enhance the culture with the bench guys being bought into winning no matter what it took.
Yeah. Travis, I'm 30 years old now, and those years were the first years of winning baseball I saw in my childhood in Pittsburgh. Talk about that whole experience, because I know I can watch that Russell Martin video where Cueto drops the ball on the mound and it still gives me chills to this day. Mm-hmm. Talk about the being a part of that team and being a part of a team that brought winning baseball back to Pittsburgh.
Again, I didn't win a World Series. I didn't make it to the Hall of Fame. I didn't play 10 years and I didn't make $100 million. Those were some of the egotistical goals that I had early in my career. Having grown up in a city like Seattle, where we had success with our sports franchises in the mid 90s and then kind of seeing what's happened since 2000, whatever, there's a deep sense of that feeling when the Mariners finally made the playoffs a couple of years ago. And it was really cool because I got to be up in Toronto as an alumni and watch the game and just see the breakthrough for the organization. It just brought me back to those moments that you're talking about, that first wild card game. Like, I've been to some of the biggest Seahawks games in the history of their franchise and one of the loudest stadiums in professional sports. Sorry, Steelers fans. I know you guys hate us, but I hate you guys too. No, I love the Steelers. I got a chance to go and meet
we'll
the coaches.
We'll cut that part out.
Yeah, no, you don't have to. We all remember the Super Bowl where you guys robbed us because of a bad ref call. So. But no, getting back to it, I think growing up as a diehard sports fan, I understood and respected as much as I hated when any city you play in, you don't have fans showing up early in the season, but I get it. Like, it's like, what has the organization done to show fans that they should spend their hard-earned money to show up to the ballpark and cheer on a team? When we were able to get to that place where not only we packed the house, but I can't compare that experience, maybe because I was on the bench, but I don't know if you guys were at the game. I mean, I'm getting chills just thinking about staying on the bench and looking up at the crowd, and the whole stadium's wearing black, and everybody's just doing this and yelling Cueto, and then all of a sudden the ball drops, and you're just like, wow. Talk about mental health and just the pressure of a moment, like all culminating. And it wasn't because of anything we did with the uniform on. It was everything that the fans brought, right? All that the 20 plus years of just frustration and bitterness towards not having a winning team in their city. To be a part of that is one of the coolest. I think second to winning a World Series, that's one of the coolest things that you can talk about, right? Is, yeah, I got to play in a city that just craved a winner the same way a Seattle sports city just craves a winner. And we were able to put that winning product on the field, even though we didn't reach the CS and in the World Series, but at least to create some sense of hope and connection between that city, which is an incredible fan base for the Steelers and incredible fan base for the Penguins, who are, storied franchises in both their respective sports. But yeah, I think, again, in terms of career highlights, that's at the very top of the list for me, is playing in the playoffs and doing it for a city that loved their team as much as the Pirates did, and understanding that decades long frustration just outburst in one game was incredible.
Yeah, wish we had the new wildcat card format now that we did then, because ran into arguably two of the hottest pitchers in all of baseball two years in a row, and what, Jake Arrieta and Bumgarner, right?
Yeah, and I think most fans that remember the DS in 2013, I was not on the active roster, but was on the bench for every one of those games and felt like we had the series where we wanted it going back to Pittsburgh, and it just didn't work out our way, which, again, we don't need to rehash the old wounds, right? But it's also, I think, looking back on it now, being 10 plus years removed from it, it's really just a cool memory for me to get to share. And hopefully at some point that video on YouTube is something I can show my kids and they can understand, like, what was PNC Park like, wild card game in 2013, because there's just nothing like it.
Want to get you out of here, Travis, but a couple quick hitter questions for you before we let you go. We just talked about some guys that were hot in the wild card games, Arrieta and Madison Bumgarner. Who was the toughest pitcher that you faced in your career?
I mean, Madison Bumgarner that year was pretty unhittable. Coming over to the Central, I'll say Aroldis Chapman, early Chapman, when he learned he could throw 101, but also throw a breaking ball for a strike. That was when the coach would look at you and say, "You're in a pinch hit." And you're like,
Shit.
"All right, here we go. Yeah, here we go. This, I guess, this is it. Left on left, 101 with a banger." But I think, yeah, looking back on it, definitely those two guys.
This isn't baseball related, but one thing I noticed on your socials is that you've gotten into cold plunges. Can
Yes.
convince me on the cold plunge. Should I do it? What's your longest time you've stayed in there?
I feel like there's so many people out there convincing with the different narratives of why to do it. I think above all else is just doing something you don't want to do on a daily basis just sets the tone for all the hard stuff that you have to do later in the day. You can do cold showers and get a similar experience. There's obviously different physical, psychological, and physiological benefits to doing the full submersion, but I did cold showers for a number of years and saw great results with that. I find a way to drag out 10 or 15 minutes every morning. I'm going to get in there at 8. It's always 8:15 by the time I get in there. And it's just like the internal voice that you have that's telling you, "Oh, you don't need to do this. You can just get comfortable today." And I think that's something we subscribe to so quickly as human beings, that it creates that level of complacency and comfort that we all crave. But it's also when we push through those hard things that we don't want to do, the feeling just, it's 3x what you feel from, "Oh, I'm just going to sit on the couch today and just check that box."
Love that.
I'd like to call this like the I'm him moment, like some moment in your career where you accomplished something, whether it was a single catch, a pinch hit at bat, a game, even if you really were zoned in, locked in, or you're like, hey, like I'm really out here, I do this. You recall like a specific play or an at bat that really resonates with you?
I would say the catch in New York is definitely the greatest physical play I'll ever make. I grew up watching Griffey, so that's the easy one. I think maybe the story most people haven't heard was 2014. I mentioned I was a bench player, was leading the league in pinch hits, worked my way back in the lineup. Kutch got hurt. I was playing every day. Polanco started struggling. I love Gregory. But as the time came, I stayed in the lineup, and they were Nixon and Gregory as my defensive replacement that year because I was swinging a hot bat. Hurdle pinch hit for me. Tabata went up there again, bench unit pulling for each other. Great. They tried to do a double steal. They didn't even let Tabby hit. And to me, it was like, if you're going to take me out of the game, if I'm hitting 350 against lefties, I know I'm a platoon guy, but the statistics show that I hit lefties this year. Unprofessionally, I went over to Hurdle and Bannister, who I have great relationships with. And I put my head down and I started using some choice language with Clint, like, you're going to pinch hit for me and you're going to double steal and you're not even going to let the guy that you gave the bat to, not, you're not even let him swing the bat. And Danny looks at me, goes, get up the tunnel, go up to the clubhouse. So I'm pissed off and I stomp up the stairs. I go put on my flats and I come back down. I'd kind of had a moment to process it, and I put my head down again. I said, guys, I'm sorry. That was horseshit. And they looked at me and they're like, hey, it wasn't. The way you delivered it was terrible, but what you're saying, like, it shows how much I cared, right? And not just because I thought it was about me being a great hitter against left-handed hitters. It's like, I felt like I was a guy that could win the game there, and I had some clutch hits in my career. So in that moment, it didn't really register. And then we're at the end of the season. We had just clinched in Atlanta. We're facing Alex Wood, who's a left-handed pitcher, and I'm standing next to Banny, and I'm standing next to Hurdle, and I think I'm leading off or hitting second against the lefty. I took him deep, but before the game, Hurdle looks at Banny. He goes, Banny, when's the last time you heard of a player that MF'd his manager in the dugout and then played every day the rest of the season? And I was just like, in that moment, I was like, I've had a lot of emotional outbursts in my life that did not lead to results like that, but in that time, I felt like it all kind of culminated for me to say, hey, I really care about this and I believe I can go out there and play. And unfortunately, I couldn't sustain that consistency throughout the rest of my career and early in my career. But that was one of those moments where it's like all the hard work, all the emotional ups and downs that I'd gone through and how I wore that on my sleeve in that moment, it resonated with those guys. And I get a chance to see them from time to time and give them big hugs and laugh about that story. Because again, just competitive juices get flowing with a bunch of testosterone and dug out. And you're going to have those moments, right, where coaches and players and butt head, but there's that genuine love, that deeper respect for each other that was there. And I think that's what building strong relationships and the people you care about is all about.
Love that. Love that. My last and final question, Travis, tying it back to 3A here and what you're doing today. What is the best advice you can give to young parents today that might be asking on how to best handle, their kids playing in sports?
Yeah, I'll plug it. Pick up the copy of Hero, www.3athletics.com. Pick up a copy of that book. In the interim, understand there's going to be a lot of pressure for you at your child's early development stages to get them involved in sports. And sports are a great thing to teach our kids life lessons. But understand, educate yourself on where your kids are at in that developmental process. You don't have to be a child psychologist specialist to just kind of learn what we can really expect from our kids and how we really need to model that behavior. Because it's easy to tell somebody to do something a certain way, but I learn this every single day with my triggers and my emotional outbursts. My kids see everything that I do, right? And they're going to emulate what they see on a daily basis from their parents. And that's a lot of pressure, but that's also one of the choices that we make when we have kids, right? And it's a difficult thing to be perfect at. Nobody's ever going to be perfect at it, but just strive to be a better version of yourself and watch what happens with your kids.
Yeah, great advice, Travis. We can't thank you enough for being here. If there's any way we could help out with 3A athletics on this side of the country, let us know. And, you know, we hope to have you on the show again, promoting 3A down the road or just talking Bucks. So thank you for being here.
You bet, guys. I appreciate the opportunity and wish you guys the best of luck as you're building this thing up. And go Buckos.
Thanks, Travis.
Let's go Bucks. Thank you.
Rockin' 101, she compliment my taste. Whiskey in my lemonade, cause I like the way it tastes. Best seats at the Pirates game, they let me run the base. Yeah, my time is like my money, cause I can't afford to waste. Wifey is a lawyer, take my date to my dates. Order steak by the plates, and then case after case. Run my race at my pace, clear the grass of the snake.